Here's Andy Udman.
How is it possible that one plant is responsible for one-third of the beef products in a country of 35 million people? I'll tell you how. XL Foods is not just a meat processing plant. They're practically their own country. I'm surprised they don't have a seat at the United Nations.
You gotta have good meat.
I'm a very big fan of hamburger.
Hands down, this pork is my favorite meat.
There's nothing any better than a good tender chicken.
I don't think about where the chicken came from.
I usually just look at price.
Every day, 5,000 cows go in one door and come out the other door on styrofoam trays. But don't worry, there are 40 meat inspectors working two shifts, which means they have to inspect 3.5 cows every 60 seconds. So
the poultry industry is as bad as I've ever seen it.
It really makes me sad to come in here and see these empty houses.
I can't say for sure how long we could continue losing $20 an animal.
There's nothing you can do about it.
I reckon I'm the only full-time farmer left in this whole area.
Mass-produced meat, it's showing itself. It's time for thinking people to return to their roots.
Certainly, if people want to have access to farm fresh food where animals are out on pasture, they should be able to have access to this kind of food. Consumers deserve to have freedom of choice.
I want to warn you, Pam Colleen is in the building, so we're going to rock the boat. It is 14 minutes after 10 o'clock. We're going to talk about meat. Anytime we talk about meat, I still remember that old Dominion commercial. It's mainly because of the meat. It was such a catchy little commercial. It's mainly because of the meat. Pam Colleen, welcome. You ready to rock and roll?
Good morning, Andy. Sure I am. Yeah, we have quite the show this morning. We have a movie producer on this morning from the United States. His name is Graham Merriweather, and he's produced a movie called American Meat, but it's not as if the topics within the movie don't apply here in Canada, so don't be deceived by the title of the movie.
Okay, so let's welcome Graham. Graham, I appreciate you joining us this morning.
Thrilled to be here, Andy.
Good morning.
Terrific. Listen, we have a little treat for you, Graham.
Yeah.
We have a guy who's a national treasure in this country. His name is Rick Mercer. And after we had the major problem with a, what do we call it, a meat manufacturing plant out in Alberta.
XL
Foods. Mm-hmm. Rick Mercer did a rant about it. It is 90 seconds long. I want to share it with you and get your thoughts on it, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, Graham, let's rock and roll with Rick Mercer.
The thing that freaks me out the most about this whole meat recall story is the sheer size of the story. How is it possible that one plant is responsible for one-third of the beef products in a country of 35 million people? I'll tell you how. XL Foods is not just a meat processing plant. They're practically their own country. I'm surprised they don't have a seat at the United Nations. Every day, 5,000 cows go in one door and come out the other door on styrofoam trays. But don't worry, there are 40 meat inspectors working two shifts, which means they have to inspect 3.5 cows every 60 seconds. So no blinking. Does anyone think this is a good idea? I mean, I know the Minister of Agriculture, he thinks it's a good idea, but does anyone on this planet think that? And here's a question. Who the hell are XL Foods? If you go to their website, you will see that they're a company that is built on trust and a firm handshake. Past that, it's all a mystery. It's all pictures of cows grazing in meadows. It's like a website for a spa. And then way down in the corner, there's a button. Recall information. I thought it was the Like Us on Facebook button, but of course they're not on Facebook because they're like a secret society. It took weeks for people to figure out who owned the company. Combine that with a Minister of Agriculture who spends half his time in witness protection, we might as well all just crawl in a freezer and shut the door. This is not a meat recall. This is a wake-up call. The entire system is designed to keep us in the dark, and if we let it stay that way, we're cooked.
Yes, Rick Mercer does have a way of saying it. We're in conversation this morning, Andy Udman, along with Pam Colleen, talking to Graham Merriweather, producer of the American documentary, American Meat. Graham, your reaction to Rick Mercer's rant?
Well, I totally agree with what he's saying, as I'm sure a lot of listeners do. The big challenge that we face with food safety is that you've got thousands and thousands of animals going through the kill floor in a very short amount of time at these big operations. Whereas if you're at a smaller slaughterhouse, you have one animal going through. If you get your meat from a local farmer, you know it's only coming from one animal as opposed to coming from thousands of animals, which means that you have a much lower chance of an E. coli in contamination. So I totally agree that mass-produced meat has some challenges that the local stuff doesn't face.
Now, let me just ask Pam, because we were just chatting off here. Pam, set up this problem we have. Farm fresh, we all love it. Organic. But we have to feed the world, so we have factory farms. How do we resolve this?
Well, and Graham did a really good job at addressing this issue in his film. One of the issues is that we just don't have the manpower. There's hardly any farmers left out there that would actually be able to man this kind of operation. It would be huge. So it's going to be driven by the consumer, and it's going to be driven very gradually. But I think Graham and I would both agree that we're seeing more consumers going out into the rural communities to seek out this farm fresh food. Correct, Graham? You're probably seeing a huge increase in demand, right?
Absolutely. A lot of people are starting to ask these types of questions and are starting to go to farmers markets. They're starting to seek out buying clubs where they can buy directly from the farmer. And the other response I would have to the feeding the world comment, which is ubiquitous when you talk to any representative of the conventional agricultural system, is that we're not feeding the world right now. We have a lot of people that are starving to death. If you go into a state in America, a state like Iowa, the 93% of the land in Iowa is being used to grow corn and soybeans. Of that corn and soybeans, none of that is going directly to human consumption. You have a lot of it going to ethanol, which is going to feed cars and not people. 40% of that's going to ethanol. You have a lot of it going to feed cows who are ruminants and have multiple stomachs to digest grass, not to eat corn. And then you also have the rest of it going into highly processed foods, becoming high fructose corn syrup, which is directly leading to an epidemic of diabetes and health-related illnesses, eating-related illnesses here in America and in Canada. So absolutely, we're not feeding the world with our current system, and we need to change the way that we produce food in order to feed ourselves and our friends.
Okay, so let's just itemize those problems that you just pointed out. So the problem with the system we have now, where we're so focused in the agricultural area on corn and soybeans, much of the corn going to ethanol, we just do not have what the consumer is wanting more and more, farm fresh, organic. So we're on a collision course. We're caught between a rock and a hard place. But let's look at the problems that the current system, the factory farm system, is creating. Number one, you're saying much of the world is still starving, and we haven't been able to address that issue.
Absolutely, and that's an issue of distribution. Another thing that I think really important to point out is that it's not healthy for one country to be dependent upon another country for its food. Food sovereignty is absolutely vital in our world. Now, I do believe that we're always going to have exports and that exports are a wonderful thing. With that said, if you look at 2008, which is a very important year for agriculture in the world, in 2008, you had the price of oil go to $147 a barrel. When that happened, you had Pilgrim's Pride, who was the largest producer of chicken in the United States, declare bankruptcy. You had Smithfield, the largest producer of pork, contract by 20%. And the reason why that happened is because Russia and China, who were the largest importers of U.S. chicken and U.S. pork, said, you know what, because the price of oil is so high, we're not going to start importing, we're not going to import food anymore from the United States and Canada. What we're going to do is we're going to ramp up our domestic production. So they did that. They started raising chickens and hogs for their own country. And subsequently, it had a massive impact on the meat industry in America and in Canada. So the idea that we can depend on a global marketplace for food, and that one country should be dependent upon another country for food, doesn't really make sense as the cost of energy continues to rise in the coming years.
And you do address this in the movie in terms of our dependence on fossil fuel and how this can increase the cost of our food supply. But in terms of the environmental impact and the carbon footprint, buying locally makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're trucking or flying or shipping product all over the world, that's going to have a lot of carbon footprint. If you're buying directly from a farmer who's down the road from you or who's an hour's drive from you, that's going to be a lot less of a footprint for that particular food. With that said, it should be said that there are efficiencies in sending large amounts in efficient large trucks. So it's not, you know, it's certainly not as if there are no emissions in a local system. But I would say that it's a more efficient system, and especially as the cost of energy goes up, we're going to need to move towards more regional food systems as opposed to large centralized global systems that really don't make sense when you can produce a lot of things locally.
Now, Graham, let me ask you this. I'm just thinking of our listeners listening right now and saying, okay, there's a lot of people starving in the world. I'm sorry, breaks my heart, but I can't do anything about it. How's all of this going to affect me? The factory farm, I go to Costco, I buy my meat, I buy my beef, I buy my pork. I'm happy. I don't see any crisis here. What's the problem? Well, let me just throw this into the mix. This is a story that has broken literally within the last 24 hours. And we've heard so much about antibiotics being used on chickens in particular. But this news flash from Washington, citing a potential threat to public health, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. FDA moved on yesterday, to phase out the widespread use of antibiotics in animals processed for meat. Is that a warning signal about our growing dependence, our huge dependence on factory farms?
Absolutely. I think that we're beginning to understand that a lot of the things in our current system don't make sense. The way that we feed so many antibiotics to animals that aren't even sick is an indication of a system that has some challenges, especially as antibiotics are becoming less and less effective because of the nature of the way that the drug is used. And one thing I would like to say, just because I think it's really important to get said, and I don't think it gets said enough in these discussions, is that I have a lot of respect for all of the conventional farmers out there. You know, when we went and we filmed all over the United States, we filmed with a lot of conventional chicken and hog and cattle raisers, and they're wonderful, hardworking people. And I want to be clear that I'm not criticizing any conventional farmers. What I'm criticizing is our current system. And we should always be sure to say thank you to farmers who are just doing what they need to do to keep their family farms going. And that goes, a family farm is also a large-scale conventional farm. Those are family farms. We're all in this together. You know, there's no farmer that we can point to and say that farmer is the problem, because those farmers are working to feed us, and they're trying to do the best they can. They're just caught up in a system that is often not rewarding them for the work that they do. To give an example, let's say you go to that Costco and you pull a bag of chicken wings off of the shelf at that Costco and you throw it in your shopping cart. The average farmer, the average chicken farmer, is only going to get about 8 cents on the dollar that you spend at the register of that Costco, which is incredible if you think about it, the amount of work that the farmer does, and they're only getting 8 cents on that dollar, with all of the middlemen and the distributors getting 92 cents on that dollar. Mm. What we really need is we need to have a system that begins to value the work of the farmer more, where the farmer becomes a price maker and not a price taker.
I could bounce a little bit back on that particular issue. I look at the chicken farmers around here, and they're doing very, very well. I look at the dairy farmers, especially with our
supply management
system. The dairy farmers are doing very, very well. Anyway, Roger has a quick comment. Roger, go ahead.
I just tuned in, Andy, so this was talked about earlier. I'm sorry. But your guests there were just talking about the Russians switching over to growing hogs in Russia and chicken in Russia, and essentially making the production their own business in their own country. And to contrast that, we're now just heard this week that we're going to make cornflakes in Thailand and bring them into Canada. How does that make any sense,
Graham,
in a food manufacturing business when others are going the other way? A big giant like Kellogg's and probably Heinz the same way will start making ketchup in Mexico or China and sending it to Canada.
Well, that's a very good point, Graham. Just so you know what he's referring to, Kellogg's just announced that And this is this city is still in shock over Kellogg's announcement. They're shutting down their cereal plant here in London, a major, major employer, excuse me, with over 500 workers. And some of the production they'll be moving to another plant in Ontario and perhaps the States, but also in Bangkok, Thailand. So that's the reference there. We are coming down to the bottom of the hour. We have to take a short break. We'll be back with the producer of the documentary American Meat, Graham Merriweather. I want to get into a number of issues on the other side of the news break, and you're welcome to join us. 643-1290, back with that in just a moment. Right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
Every day, 5,000 cows go in one door and come out the other door on styrofoam trays. But don't worry, there are 40 meat inspectors working two shifts, which means they have to inspect 3.5 cows every 60 seconds. So how is it possible that one plant is responsible for one-third of the beef products in a country of 35 million people? I'll tell you how. XL Foods is not just a meat processing plant. They're practically their own country. I'm surprised they don't have a seat at the United Nations.
Okay, everybody remembers Rick Mercer's rant about the XL meat plant in Alberta. We're going to get into the meat issue in a major way because there's a lot at stake. With our guest this morning. We're also, I promise you, going to have a lively discussion about the comments from our medical officer of health, Dr. Christopher Mackey, saying he's flabbergasted at Pam Colleen. Actually, he didn't quite say that, but he's saying, I'm flabbergasted, questioning the whole idea the flu shot is irresponsible. Well, you know who's questioning it? Doctors and nurses. Oh, it's a crazy world we live in. Just before we get back to our guest this morning, John, what's on your mind this morning on this issue of meat?
Well, on the meat issue, interesting topic this morning. I just finished reading a book about 2 months ago. I can't remember who wrote it, but I'm sure people can find it on the internet, but it's called Fast Food Nation. Now, it's about a 10-year-old book, but talks about the meat and the farming process with potatoes, of course, for French fries, but especially chicken and beef with, say, McDonald's, Burger King, that sort of thing, and how these basically factories where they process this meat, and they send in undercover people to see how it's done. And it really does get you thinking about whether you want to eat that meat that comes out of these big processors. And, you know, I have to be honest, I have not stopped buying my meat from the local big box stores, but I'm really seriously thinking that in the new year I'm going to start looking into getting local meat from the local farmers and see what the taste is like on that. And I think it has to be better.
John, great call.
On that note, I'll just guide everybody. If you can Google in London area organic growers, you will find that there are several pasture-raised operations in the London area. So we're kind of blessed to have so many farmers here in London.
Is there a difference in the taste?
Absolutely. Even we'll talk about this with Graham in a second here, but in his movie, he does a great job at addressing this. He even interviews conventional farmers who have dual systems. So they have their conventional system and they have a pasture-raised system. And the farmers admit that they prefer the taste of the pasture-raised pork, for example.
Graham, share those conversations, if you would. I saw some of them online. You're saying there are factory farmers out there who wish that their product was as good as the organic. They just haven't found a way to do it yet.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think a lot of large-scale conventional farmers will tell you that they produce a meat that doesn't taste as good as the chickens that a lot of older people would say, when I grew up, it tasted different. You know, the animals were eating different things outside. That makes a big difference. A lot of them concede that point, but what they come back to is just saying, look, if we're going to actually feed the world, if we're going to feed the masses of people, we're creating an inferior tasting product, but it's a much cheaper financially product.
Wow.
A financially cheaper product. That's a point that is often conceded. And one thing that's worth pointing out is that in the 90s, the pork industry decided that they were going to try to take all the fat out of pork. And what they did was they started breeding a leaner pig. They had the famous ad campaign, the other white meat. And what they did was they bred the flavor out of the pork. So when you go and you buy directly from a farmer at your farmer's market or a local farmer, they have a much fattier pig. And so that fattier pig, that breed like a Berkshire or an Osebeck, those breeds are going to be dripping with flavor because the fat is where the flavor is. And the conventional pork really is missing on that flavor.
Graham, I would think there'd be a lot of pressure from high-end chefs who, you know, for whom the price is not the issue. They want the very best and the tastiest meats that are out there, and they're putting pressure on society generally to say, we want these good products, so stand back. We're going to get them, and if we have to go to the organic farmers, we're not going to take the factory farm product.
Absolutely. Chefs are driving this movement in a lot of places because, like you said, taste is everything for a chef, and you're not going to have customers in your seats if the food doesn't taste good. And so the reality is that a lot of high-end, high-dollar restaurants are places that are sourcing locally. And the reality is that a lot of the more financially inexpensive restaurants are not able to do that. So unfortunately, a lot of times, the people who get access to this food are people that can afford to eat at those high-dollar restaurants.
But there is an exception to that rule, and that is the chain Chipotle's, which is a remarkable story because they buy from Neiman Ranch in the United States, and the owner of Chipotle's, the founder, the CEO of Chipotle, started the operation by bringing in this pasture-raised pork, and he will not compromise on that issue.
Absolutely, and that's one of the stories that we told in our film that I think is really inspiring because it shows that there's an opportunity for this type of food to be sourced into large scale. You know, there's 1,500 or 1,600 Chipotles in the United States and Canada, and they have pasture-raised pork in all of their restaurants. They even have locally sourced pork in about five of their restaurants, which is a pretty small percentage. But the fact that they're moving towards a more regional system, we tell the story of how they began to source their pork from Polyface Farms in Virginia for their Charlottesville, Virginia, and their Harrisonburg, Virginia locations. And the reason they're doing that is partially the taste, partially the story for their customers. But then a big part of that is also the transportation, because they only have to truck that pig about 85 miles total from the slaughterhouse to the Chipotle, whereas in the current system, you have to truck that animal hundreds and sometimes thousands of miles to get to where it needs to go. And you can imagine as the cost of energy continues to rise, or if the cost of energy continues to rise, these local regional food systems are going to make a lot of economic sense. So we may well see that Chipotle is at the forefront of where all of the large restaurants would head in an economy in which the cost of energy goes up.
Let me just make a comparison here. We're dealing in this country with the shock of just being told by Canada Post that while they would love to keep up door-to-door delivery, it's same issue in the United States. Fewer people, dramatically fewer people, are using the mail system. Nobody writes a letter anymore. So they have just announced the end over the period of the next few years, 5 years, of phasing out home delivery. What would you say, Graham, is the absolutely number one issue as we try to get away from the factory farm and get the quality of the organic product, the locally grown, fresh product with no chemicals? What is the overriding or the most pressing issue which will determine in the future how successful we're going to be in getting the product we want, or are the economics going to dictate that we have to stick with the factory farm formula?
Well, I would say the number one thing is you. So if you're driving your car, if you're sitting at home, the way that you determine to eat your food each day, the three meals that you eat collectively as a continent in North America, we create the food system that we have because of the food that we decide to buy. So if you decide to go out to a McDonald's or a fast food restaurant, we're going to continue to have the same system. If you decide to go to the farmer's market and pay a farmer directly for that food and allow the farmer to take 100 cents on that dollar that you spend, then we will grow and have a much larger percentage of our food system be a regional, local, pasture-based food system. So it really is up to you. And if you make a decision to change the food that you eat, we will see a collective impact. And collectively, we will have a new food system for the coming years.
Now, Graham, you're a filmmaker, but you're a consumer as well. And it sounds to me like you did this movie as a call to action. And it looks to me as well on your website that you're pursuing this, not just as a filmmaker, but you've got some activism that is clear on your website where you're trying to connect more farmers to consumers throughout the United States.
Absolutely. I see our role in the filmmaking process is not really the role of an artist, but the role of a community builder or a storyteller. And so what we've been doing is hosting screenings all across the United States, where we had screenings for FFA chapters, we had screenings for universities, we had screenings for people that are interested in this topic of food. And some of the most heartwarming stories from those screenings were, we had a screening I remember in Dayton, Ohio, where a young farmer showed up, and because of the excitement that people felt after they finished watching the film, they purchased 14 shares in a CSA from his farm, which was real money in that farm's bank account. And so, you know, we're looking to help the regional food system with our film so that people can see the film, get inspired, and then take action and actually go out and buy food from the regional, the local food system.
We have a country music station as part of our family here at Bell Media in London, and I was here listening to one of the songs. She thinks my tractor's sexy. but what you're saying is people are finding locally grown, fresh product is sexy, and that's the trend. That's the tsunami that's coming in right now that the Costco's and the other major suppliers out there are going to have to deal with.
Absolutely. And there's a misconception in the United States that only the food movement is only happening in the East Coast and the West Coast. And I can say that that is absolutely not the case. We did screenings where we would get a chance to go to the farmers market in Iowa City, in Minnesota, in you name the state, we were there. And farmers markets are thriving across this continent. People are deciding that they want to go and see where their food comes from. And then they discover that, guess what, it tastes better. And you get to shake the hand of the farmer that grew your food, and you get a sense of knowing where something in your life comes from.
Marvelous. Marvelous, Graham. Graham, we're almost out of time. Pam, where can people access this documentary?
Well, Graham, his name is Graham Merriweather, and he's got a couple of websites. One of his websites is AmericanMeatFilm.com. That's AmericanMeatFilm.com. And he has another website called LeaveItBetter.com. LeaveItBetter.com.
Leave it better. Let's leave it better by giving them, Graham, if you would, a 30-second takeaway. Put it in a little box. We'll put a little bow on the top. What is the takeaway that you're hoping our listeners will take away from this conversation?
I hope that people will appreciate the amount of work that our continent's farmers do. I think a lot of times, wherever you decide to go and eat, if you decide to go to eat at a McDonald's, you go to decide to get your food from a local farmer's market, just make sure that you reflect upon the work that the people who feed us do, because I feel like farmers are some of the most underappreciated people in our culture, and that we deserve to thank them and to honor them. And I believe the system that thanks and honors our farmers by rewarding them economically is the local regional food system. So whatever you decide to eat, reflect upon the fact today that a farmer put that on your plate.
There we go. And I can hear the applause from all across the area, all my friends out on the farm, Mike Fife and Wayne Hoyer and Ray Dykstra, and all of the other hundreds of farmers. They applaud what you're saying, as we all do. Graham, so much appreciate you joining us this morning. Graham Merriweather, producer of the documentary film American Meat. Thanks for joining us, Graham.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks, Pam.
Thanks, Graham.
Okay, now, Pam. I'm getting email about the flu shot. We're going to get into that. I'm not going to let you go here before we get into this flu shot, and I want to ask you about the comments from our medical officer of health. I don't see your name, Pam Colleen, but it says I'm flabbergasted, questioning the whole idea of the flu shot is irresponsible. Pam, how dare you? I will ask you about that when we come back. Folks, we're getting the email. We're getting the phone calls. I have a sense that we're going to talk about this into the next hour. 643-1290. What do you think of the comments of our medical officer of health? It's irresponsible to even talk about the whole idea of the flu shot not being something you'd want to do, really. Back with that in just a moment. Right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJAB. Couldn't believe this when I heard this morning. I thought, wow, this will have Pam Colleen smiling. The front page story in the London Free Press. Nurses strike back. Ontario Nurses Union has declared war on hospitals that require nurses to get a flu shot or wear a mask. I happen to have a family member who is in that category. She's a nurse in Northern Ontario, has to wear the mask because she will not have the flu shot. The Ontario Nurses Association, the ONA, is running radio ads in cities whose hospitals, like London, Ontario, stepped up efforts to get staff vaccinated before the flu season peaks. The campaign stunned public health officials and hospital leaders who say the nurses union is distorting the truth and threatening people's health. And here's the reaction that I'm going to present to Pam Colleen from our medical officer of health, Dr. Christopher Mackey. He says, I am flabbergasted. It risks harming the health of the public, their members, and the patients they serve. Questioning the whole idea of the flu shot is irresponsible. Pam, have at it.
Well, I mean, I get emails from nurses, registered nurses. I speak on a regular basis to registered nurses. They come to my classes. They're not happy about this. When I ask them, will you come on the radio and talk about it? They can't come on the radio and talk about it because they would lose their jobs. So you look at the pickle that they're in. And I don't know if there's a lawyer in London that is stepping forward to help the nurses, because what is happening is unacceptable. Chris Mackey's comments are irresponsible. He's not even looking at the fact that there may be another side to this story, that science has been surfacing now for many years, showing that using flu shots may not be as efficacious as they claim, may have safety issues. There are new studies coming up. We've had Dr. Tom Jefferson of the Cochrane Collaboration on the air, for example. And he's calling this kind of practice where these nurses are being forced to wear masks, he's calling it tyranny.
Let me ask you two blunt questions. The flu shot, is it effective?
No. Look at the Cochrane Collaboration. Look at the research they've done. They're not the only ones who've done this kind of research. There's more and more research surfacing.
Question number two, is the flu shot safe?
Well, there's all sorts of questionable ingredients in there. I mean, there could be mercury, there could be aluminum in there, MSG. I mean, there's all sorts of potential toxins in there. And I just don't see how anybody could say it's safe to add things like aluminum into your bloodstream.
Let me just share an email from Larry. Can you believe the arrogance of our medical office? Clearly, he has only ever seen one side of the argument. I do not take a flu shot because of all the toxic ingredients they include in the shot. In addition, people that have the shot can also be a spreader of the airborne transmission of the bug. The flu shot is another example of why our healthcare system is bankrupt. Education regarding how to improve our immune systems and maintain healthy bodies and minds is the direction we need to go. Big food and big pharma are picking us off one at a time. They have too much influence over healthcare, government, and even the media. Have a blessed day. Andy, let's go to the phones. Jim, your thoughts.
Thank you, Pam. Finally, someone is on the radio championing the idea of bad science. I'm not anti-immunization, but I am anti-bad science. And the flu shot program, as Tom Jefferson has said, is a public relations campaign, not a public health campaign. There's just too many things that can infect us with similar type symptoms to the flu. There are over 600 viruses, 400 outside of the flu regime, that carry the same effects as the flu. And when you're only picking two or three antigens for a worldwide population, it doesn't make any sense at all. It's just rotten science.
Jim, you have so much to say. We're going to continue this on the other side of the 11 o'clock news. We'd really have love to hear from you. Pam, you'll love this one. Andy, if you get the chance, can you please ask Pam to comment on the claims made by Alex Jones that they are purposely adding cancer virus to flu shots?
Well, I don't know about that, but I just know that the whole campaign around flu shots it just doesn't make any sense. It's illogical. I mean, you look at the fact that one email that you read a little while ago, people need to be educated on what they can do at home to get their immune system strong. And that's not what's happening. You see, people rely on the flu shot for their immune system, essentially, so that they can go out and eat all this sugar and not take care of themselves. It makes people too complacent. There's a lot people can do to make their immune system strong.
Okay, Jim, just before the top of the hour, make it quick.
About 5 years ago, I asked my doctor about his opinion on the flu shot. He says, I can't speak because I'll get fired. I'll get reprimanded. I said to him, okay, take the blue pen and the red pen out of your pocket. Put them on the table. Which one? I said to him, the red pen represents you're against the flu shot. The blue pen represents you're for it. He picked up the blue pen, he put it in my hand, and he said, have a great day.
Jim, you nailed it. We're going to continue this on the other side. I mean, that says it all.
Well,
I mean, and here's Dr. Mackey.
But it was until recently, 60% of healthcare workers were not getting the flu shot, Andy. That says a lot right there.
But now, with a gun to their heads.
Now they have a gun to their heads. But somebody also needs to investigate the CEOs of the hospitals to see what kind of incentives are being put forward to them to push this effort.
Quick comment about GlaxoSmithKline.
Well, I think you better look up their rap sheets, everyone. Go into Wikipedia and just look up GlaxoSmithKline, scroll down. They have all the criminal record there. If you can trust a company that has a criminal record that long, I mean, you know, you may as well believe in Santa Claus. I just, you know.
Don't go stepping on Santa Claus or I'll have protesters in front of the building. Pam Killeen, it's been a great hour.
Thanks, Andy.
You so much. Okay. 11 o'clock news. No, we're not going to get into whether Santa Claus is real. No, we're not going to do that. But we're going to talk about whether the health benefits of a flu shot are real and safe. Be interested in your thoughts when we come back in just a moment. Right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.